Hello and welcome to the second part of our exploration of the environment and the Americas through the lens of the humanities. Last time we were looking at the history of the human engagement with the environment, and particularly the way that humans saw themselves as part of the environment from a pre-Columbian conception of humans as part of a oneness with the environment around them, to the settler and colonial understanding of the environment as a resource to be exploited. Today we're going to look at the imaginative response to the environment, whether that be as part of a wider cultural movement such as the Romantics in the early 19th century, or on an individual or communal basis as a way of comprehending the challenges of the situation we're currently in. To talk about these issues, I'm joined by three Eastern Arc experts from the universities of East Anglia, Essex and Kent. Hazel Marsh is a senior lecturer in Latin American Studies at UEA. Susan Oliver is a professor in the Department of Literature, Film and Theatre Studies at Essex. And Karen Jones is a professor of Environmental and Cultural History at Kent. I started by asking Susan about the artists she'd come across in her work in Canada.
We live in a time when we're constantly reading about the acceleration of ice loss. There are a number of artists that have emerged in recent years who have engaged in direct ways with what is actually happening. Hawaiian artist Sean Yoru, whose work is a crossover between street art, installation art, and environmental art, undertook a project a short while ago in northern Canada where he painted murals on melting ice floes. And the murals were very realistic, they were like 3D dimensional images of a human face, perhaps with an arm extended. So as the ice melted, the human body collapsed into the water. And that bringing together of the loss of ice and the potential loss of our species was something I think was particularly well done. He's one artist that I've been very interested in. There's another artist who is also a biological scientist whose work I came across when I was at the University of Wyoming just a short while ago. And that is an artist by the name of Brandon Ballinger. And Brandon Ballinger works on monstrosity and the mutation of species. And he put together a very interesting exhibition titled Wasteland based on polluted waterways in Quebec and Eastern Canada. The exhibition was deeply moving because it actually turned the bodies of creatures that had no chance of survival because of the degree of mutation that they had developed congenitally into an aesthetic art form that was uncomfortable to view because you looked at it and it actually looked quite beautiful. So it raised questions. It had us thinking how we respond to mutation, how we respond to pollution, how we respond to environmental change and the devastation that it causes species beyond our own, how we relate to monstrosity. There's a very beautiful photographic part of that exhibition, Requiem for the Injured Snowflakes, which superimposes images of tiny toad tadpoles that had developed degrees of mutation. And he turned this into a film that was set against a minimalist score, very elegiac in terms of thinking about the environment feeding back to us a sense of our grief in a way that makes us feel better in order perhaps to move on. And that in itself was designed to create a sense of discomfort in the viewer. So I think people who do this kind of environmental art, obviously they're very important to our understanding of damage that's occurring in the world around us, but also encouraging us to think about how art is a form of activism.
Thank you, Susan. Art is a form of activism. That goes back to what we were talking initially about, where environmental humanities came from, in as much as it was a response to the way that the environment was changing, the climate was changing. Has there been a clear increase in artistic engagement with the environment since the 60s and 70s? Or has it always been there? I mean, we have, you know, the likes of Walt Whitman or some poets and writers like that. But has there been a perceived upspike in the amount of artistic interpretation and responses to the environment in the last 30 or 40 years?
Yeah, I think that's a really interesting question, because if you think about it as a medium, the monumental landscapes of the American West are perennially popular. If you think about Thomas Moran, think about photography, think about Ansel Adams or Georgia O'Keeffe, and that sense of decay and beauty in the desert. So I think there's a long trajectory of being enthralled and captivated by these spaces. So I suppose the two things perhaps that for me have changed, the nature of the urgency of the activist thread and the nature of the human impact. When John Muir is writing, he's concerned about sheep as locusts munching away alpine meadowland in a localized space, or logging in a localized space, whereas 100 and some years later, the issue is planetary in scope. The scale of the question of the destruction is one thing that changes, and the difference in media, with digital media and the explosion in data and information, just the volume of artistic production is so much greater.
That's true. And the way we interact has changed. And both of you talked about art as a form of activism and the nature of the urgency for that activism. I'd like to move on to that question about activism and how we understand environment and how we ensure that the effects we are having on the environment are perhaps minimized or mitigated. Hazel, I know you've been working with the University of Manizales in Colombia. Do you want to say a bit about that project?
Yes, that project is Moving with Risk. It's led by Professor Roger Pugh in the School of International Development and another colleague, Teresa Armijos Cornell. And together with the University of Manizales, with a team there in the Institute of Social Psychology, led by Lina Zambrano, we've been using the arts to better understand the experiences, skills and capacities of people displaced by conflict in Colombia. So Colombia, like the rest of Latin America, has a history of conquest, colonialism, slavery, exclusion, poverty. In addition, though, Colombia has quite a unique geography. Its main cities, Medellin, Barranquilla, Cali, and Bogota, are separated by towering mountain ranges and dense tropical jungles. So throughout much of its history, a lot of provincial regions have developed in relative isolation from the capital. In addition to that, it's one of the countries with the highest numbers of environmental hazards, such as earthquakes, landslides, flooding, volcanic eruption. And then thrown in with that, throughout the 20th century, it's a country that's experienced violent conflict, which started out as conflict between the liberals and the conservatives. After the 1960s, leftist guerrillas also became involved in confrontations with the state, right-wing paramilitaries, all related to issues of exclusion, poverty, political exclusion, land access, international market dynamics, and reactions to this. So currently, Colombia has one of the highest populations of internally displaced people in the world. It's just under 8 million, which is about 16% of the population. And these people are displaced from their rural land, where they're self-sufficient with small holdings, into urban or peri-urban areas. And the land that they find to resettle on is often quite dangerous to live on. It's land that floods, it's land where there are landslides. And people are well aware of that environmental risk that they face, but they choose that over and above the risk of violence, the loss of relatives, conflict over land use in the places they fled from. So we've been working using the arts to better understand the trajectories of risk that these people have been through. People who've lived through such trauma and loss, in order to access legal reparations from the state, they do have entitlements. They have to present themselves as victims and fit into predetermined labels of victimhood. There's a set question list that they have to respond to. And what we've been doing instead is to approach these people and explain that we want to learn about their experiences, but also the skills and capacities, how they've rebuilt their lives in new places away from their original homes, in order to support their capacity to make the places they live in safer, and to support the capacities of the institutions, the government and non-government institutions that support them. They often find these people hard to reach. So we've been using the arts in various ways. So instead of a traditional interview and asking people the date of their displacement, what happened, we've been asking them, first of all, to share with us a song that they like. We listen to that song and then they talk to us about why that song is significant for them. And very often it reminds them of a partner, romantic partner, the place they grew up in. So they can start their story from a different point of entry that they choose. They have more control over their narrative. That was just one part of a longer process of using various forms of artistic expression to learn about these people's lives. And it culminated with the communities choosing whatever artistic forms of expression that they chose, such as dance, muralism, storytelling, to tell their collective stories of displacement and their strengths, not from a position of victimhood, but people who've made conscious decisions to talk to us about how they manage the environmental risks they live with. In that way, the arts have opened up new spaces for people who were very much excluded in Colombian society. We don't know much about them. I mean, most of us, if we think of Colombia, we think of representations in popular culture and film, and we think of drugs and violence and war. So we've heard the perspectives of a different sector of society on their own terms to a greater extent by using the arts to articulate their stories and their skills and their strengths and how they've been displaced, but also how they've rebuilt communities. And that's where the art has opened these spaces for people to tell their stories in new ways.
Mm. I think that's key, using the arts to articulate experience and articulate our relationship with the environment. Susan, did you want to come in?
Yeah, I was really interested in the way that Hazel was identifying the importance of song there as a means of coping with displacement, as a means of understanding different places where people have had to adapt to living. I've just completed a book on Walter Scott, and Scott said at one point that if only we had access to all the old sayings, we'd have a very curious history of the nation. And I was sort of wondering, Hazel, the extent to which song is actually part of the coping process when people move, the process of dealing with the violence of displacement. I suppose there I'm thinking too about the idea of slow violence, which we don't recognise as violence initially. And Rob Nixon has theorised this in his book, Slow Violence and the Environmentalism of the Poor, that violence that doesn't happen spectacularly and doesn't happen quickly is all too easily not seen as a form of violence. And the people you were talking about, they've moved from traditional homelands to new places. They, in turn, have an impact on those places themselves. I wonder if you wanted to say a little bit more about that and the extent to which song is both something which is a celebration of being able to adapt and also something perhaps a little bit elegiac about something that is problematic in itself.
Yeah, song and music, it's very much bound up with our sense of identity and with our memory. And we all have that experience of hearing a fragment of a song and it triggering autobiographical memories. For people to share a song with us, it's a way to share their identity with us in a very direct and powerful way. And even if those songs are sad, there's a whole literature on the use of sad music to regulate our emotions, to manage these feelings that we have, for instance. But by starting out, you know, once we'd introduced the project and what our objectives were and what our aims were and invited people to participate, you could see from people's faces when we said the first thing we'd like you to do is have a conversation with us and share with us a song that is important for you, that has significance for you. You could see people smiling. This was something completely new for them, the idea that instead of being asked questions, they were going to share with us something bound up in their own sense, their own taste, their own sense of identity. And the entry points into people's life stories varied tremendously. It's not that everyone chose a song that reminded them of the same point in their life. They started out in the present, in the past, and from there accessed memories, and but not just memories, but feelings about their experiences. Yeah, it was a very powerful research tool.
Wouldn't it be interesting if we had access to songs from a very long time ago? And here I'm looking back to perhaps Neolithic societies. We don't know what those societies sounded like. It seems to me that song is one of the most spontaneous of the forms of artistic expression. We sing spontaneously to cheer ourselves. We sing to soothe children. We sing because of joy. We sing for all sorts of reasons. It's very closely connected with our immediate response to the environment.
The only thing we know about pre-Columbian instruments, musicologists have identified hundreds of instruments, but we don't know how the music sounded, but there are images in murals and depicted on vases and drinking pots. Those sounds probably imitated the sounds of nature, to get back to the environment.
I was just going to jump in there and say there's an emerging scholarship that connects up sort of sensory histories with environmental histories that thinks about sound in nature. You know, for instance, what should a national park sound like? What's the expectation of a sonic preserved space? You want to hear the pristine wild. You might want to hear a wolf. So there's this whole sonic landscape that codes that human story and that interaction between us and the rest of the natural world, which I think is incredibly interesting as an alternative way of trying to figure out this relationship that we have with the world around us.
It's interesting, I think, how we use words to express that engagement with the world around us and how we use actual sound itself and very early sounds are believed to have been very onomatopoeic. So they were something that represented something in terms of what it sounded like. So at that moment, music and speech are very close to one another.
Over the course of the last two podcast episodes, we've explored the way that humans have interacted with the environment, for better and for worse. And today we've understood how specific artists and specific projects have engaged very positively with the environment. I wanted to finish by giving the last word to Hazel about how the arts can be used in a positive way to enable and support change.
What the arts can do is touch the emotions in a way that perhaps a political speech or a text can't do. When Salvador Allende was elected to presidency in Chile in 1970, the first democratically elected socialist president, he stood beneath a banner on stage that said, "There is no revolution without songs." And he's referring to this power that we attribute to music and to the arts in general, to touch our emotions, to bypass in some ways the cognitive and actually really move us in a way that might perhaps lead to action. I'm not saying, it's not as simple as saying, you know, songs can change the world, but certainly songs and the arts can touch the emotions in ways that a political speech or a printed text might not do. It's not enough to have the facts. We need to be moved to action, and that's what the arts can do.
There is no revolution without songs. That's an appropriate place for us to end today, by understanding and appreciating that it is through the humanities and the arts that we are able to better understand the environment of which we're part. So I'd like to end by thanking all three of today's participants: Hazel Marsh from UEA, Susan Oliver from Essex, and Karen Jones from Kent. I'd also like to thank all of those who are involved in the production of this podcast, including Jack Harvey and Chris Martin for supplying the music. And I'd like to thank you too for tuning in today to hear more about the work going on across the Eastern Arc.